Hi, everybody. Today we have sources which are in the PowerPoint, but they will also be in the chat. They are in the chat if you want to, look at them, open them up side by side, whatever you want to do. And of course, our learning, as always, is in memory of those who have been murdered, fallen soldiers, people from the 7th of October, in the merit of our soldiers' success and the safe and quick return of our hostages. Today, we are focusing on Gaza itself, not the whole area, which is what really we're going to be doing for the rest of the time, but the city of Gaza, and specifically on the Jewish history of the city of Gaza. I want to preface this by saying that much of the material that I have today, it comes from one source. There's an Israeli researcher named Chagai Huberman. This is his thing. He's fascinated by this stuff, and he's written a lot about it. So really, he gets the credit. Okay, so we talk about Gaza, and this was a conversation that was happening a lot 20 years ago in the whole wake of the discussion about Gush Katif and leaving Gush Katif. Is Gaza considered part of the land of Israel? Right, and there were people who were very pro the disengagement who said, it's not really part of Eretz Israel. It's really Chutz La'aretz, which is true and not true, right? True in the sense that in Tanakh times, as we saw last time, it was Philistine. Later than that, it was a coastal city, which means it was a mixed city, like Jaffa, like Akko. It didn't have a wholly Jewish character. There were many periods where Jews were expelled. The Jewish community was expelled. We're going to see that when we go through the timeline. On the other hand, we have Jewish life in Gaza intermittent. Right in between the times of being expelled from the time of the Hashmonaim until 1929. So, and at times, the Jewish community in Gaza is more important, more significant than Jewish communities in places like Tzfat or Jerusalem. So it's definitely a place that we need to understand its Jewish history, its Jewish background, and that's really what we're going to dive into today. In the last couple of months, we've had some very interesting pictures that have come out of Gaza in terms of Jewish return there. Towards the end, we'll have a short video that I think is also fascinating. But this, of course, is Hanukkah of our soldiers in Gaza. You can see the tanks, of course, in the background and the Chanukiah in the foreground. So it really, to me, was a perfect picture to highlight this idea of Jewish Gaza. Okay, let's continue. Where are we talking about, right? So last time we really took a look at the whole area, the whole Gaza Strip, the Otef, the Gaza envelope. Today we're going to focus on the city. Okay. The city, of course, the importance is the port, but the original part of the city starts from a tell called Tell HaSakan, which is kind of south of today's Gaza City. Eventually there's another tell, Tell El-Ajul. The port area is not really significant until Byzantine times, even though the port itself is important, but the area is not settled so much. Starts out as a small tell and then it expands. The picture on the right here, which is in Hebrew, but you can get the sense of it, is the various different neighborhoods of the current Gaza City, which is a lot of urban sprawl, right? Very, very big. You can see in the middle here, or middle slightly to the right, the old city, right? The Ir HaAtikah, which doesn't necessarily mean the tell. It means, a city that's going back more likely towards Mamluk times. We're going to be talking about the Jewish community, which was in the center here in this area of Zaytun, actually in the highest part of town, as well as on the coast. We'll come back to that. But those are the two areas that we're going to be talking about when we talk about Jewish life in Gaza. The first time we hear, I know it's a scary looking timeline, but it'll give us a kind of a bigger picture. Okay. The first time we hear in sources, outside of Tanakh, about the place called Gaza or Gaza, right? Always confusing the G and the not G, right? But we hear about it from Egyptian texts. Okay, Paro Tutmos, 1468 BCE, huge conquest of the land of Canaan, and one of the places he conquers is a place called Gazat. Right? Now, the name is, it seems, a Semitic name. Okay? It's not an Egyptian name. We hear about it again not so long afterwards in the El Amarna letters, Azati, right? Gazat, Azati, same place. El Amarna letters are letters that were written by, among others, Canaanite rulers back to the Paro in Egypt, because he was really the ruler of the land of Canaan, with lots and lots and lots of flattery and then a very blunt request for supplies, defense, right? All different kinds of things. So we hear about Aza already through Egyptian texts, right? Paro Tutmos talks about it. The El Amarna letters talk about it. What's the name Aza? Okay, so Chagai Huberman suggests, we don't really have a proof for it, he suggests that the word comes from the word oz, right? Oz as in strength, as in brazen, right? As, and perhaps because, as we're going to see when we go through this timeline, Gaza keeps being conquered over and over and over again. So there's a lot of battles that are going on. Now, this is not particularly unusual in the land of Israel, right? Jerusalem is constantly conquered. The other coastal cities are conquered. But perhaps this name of Oz, of something that's connected to bravery or courage, maybe that's where the name comes from. By the 12th century, we have the invasion of the Philistines into the land, and Gaza becomes one of the Pentapolis, right? The five Philistine cities, something we talked about last time. By the time we get to the Hellenistic period, Alexander the Great comes along, besieges the city, conquers it. The Maccabees conquer Gaza, but don't hold on to it. And it's only in the first century before the Common Era, with the Hasmonean ruler Alexander Yanai, he adds Gaza to his Jewish Hasmonean kingdom. And here we're going to see in 61 something that's just going to keep on happening. The Jews settle in Gaza. They establish a community. They're expelled. They leave for a while, they come back, establish a community, they're expelled, right? So that first expulsion here is the Romans. And here's where we have something fascinating. We have the beginning of a special calendar, okay? Lots of places today, you know, we all have our secular calendar, our Jewish calendar, and that's it. But there were a lot of, like, personalized calendars, calendars that were connected to rulers, calendars that were connected to specific events, okay? So the Gaza calendar, the year one of Gaza is 61 BCE. And the Jews actually use this calendar because even though they're expelled, even though it's a terrible thing, we have this Gaza calendar in an inscription from a Jewish synagogue. Okay, so that's just something interesting to notice. Jews come back. Here I wrote third, fourth century. We're going to see that perhaps there's evidence that it's even earlier, even in Roman times, not only in Byzantine times. By the fourth century, the Roman Emperor Constantine founds kind of an extension or a suburb of Gaza, Gaza Mayumas, by the port. Okay? We have the synagogue, the Jewish synagogue there. The Muslims conquer the city. The Jews stick around. We now have an addition of Karaites, of Samaritans. But again, crusaders come, expel the Jews. Takes a while. The Jews come back under Mamluk rule, and the Jewish community in Gaza becomes very, very important. And these are kind of the golden years of the community in Gaza. 15th, 16th, 17th century. Okay? We're going to talk about the Najara family and probably Gaza's most famous or really infamous moment, Shabtai Tzvi. Okay? The Shabtai Tzvi movement really takes off with Nathan of Gaza, with this rabbi who comes from Gaza. And that's also kind of the downfall of the Jewish community. By 1799, Napoleon comes, conquers. The Jewish community is a shadow of its former self. Again, early 19th century, Jews are expelled. Again, late 19th century, they come back. Right? The British conquer. 1929, riots, and the Jews are gone, right? And the Jews in this case have a better ending than, for example, a place like Hebron. They are not massacred. We'll see in the story how that happens. They're saved. It's not from the goodwill of the Arabs, but from the protection of the British and of an Arab friend of theirs. But the Jews are evacuated from the city. 1929 is the end of our story. Until today. Okay, so that's our kind of big picture. We'll take a quick look at the Philistines. Not a lot. We talked about them last time, but you can't ignore Shimshon, right? Samson and the Gates of Gaza. We have two stories in the whole set of Samson stories where he goes to Gaza. Okay? One is kind of while he's still at the height of his powers, and that's where he goes down to Gaza to find himself a lady friend, but the people of the town decide that they are going to trap him. They lock the gates, but he gets up in the middle of the night. At midnight, he got up, grasped the doors of the town gate along with the two gateposts and pulled them out along with the bar, placed them on his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that is near Hebron. We're going to see this Hebron-Aza connection a few times, right? It's interesting. First of all, we have this fabulous mosaic. Take a look at this picture over here on the left of Shimshon carrying the gates of Gaza on his shoulders, right? There's nothing else that that picture could be. This is from a synagogue that's still being excavated near the Kinneret. It's in a place called Hukok. It has very, very interesting and unusual mosaic pictures. Not your standard zodiac, Akedah Yitzchak, but all kinds of wild pictures, and this is one of them. There seems to have been an affinity in the Galilee communities for the story of Shimshon. We're not quite sure why, but this is a great example. The second time we hear of Shimshon in Aza is a much more terrible story, and that's when he's captured. He's lost his strength. His hair has been shorn by Delilah. The Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes. They brought him down to Gaza and shackled him in bronze fetters, and he became a mill slave in the prison. Right? If you know your Milton, Eyeless in Gaza at the mill with slaves. Right? That's exactly what's going on here. And then he's brought out to kind of entertain the Philistines in their temple. And he calls out to God. He says, "Give me my strength one last time to take revenge of the Philistines, if only for one of my two eyes," right? "Zachreini na v'chazkeni na," remember me and give me strength just this once. And he embraced the two middle pillars that the temple rested upon, one with his right arm, one with his left, and leaned against them. Samson cried, "Let me die with the Philistines. Tamut nafshi im plishim," right? This classic cry of the suicide martyr. "If I'm going to die, they're coming with me." The temple came crashing down on the lords, on all the people. Those who were slain by him as he died outnumbered those who had been slain by him when he lived. So Shimshon's story also culminates and ends in Gaza. Remember this phrase of the gates of Gaza? We're going to come back to it in our fourth class when we talk about settlement in the area of the Gaza envelope, and it's going to be part of a very famous speech. So keep it in mind. I'm not looking at the questions. I promise I will leave time at the end, or I will do my best. Okay, moving on. Alexander the Great. This is one of the depictions of him. Did he look like this? Who knows? But Alexander the Great, of course, is this incredible conqueror who sweeps out of Macedonia and, in less than 10 years, essentially conquers the known world, right? Conquers all the way from Greece, all the way to India. And of course, he wants Gaza as well. Gaza is a really good prize because it's, and that's why everybody's always trying to conquer it, because of what we talked about last time. It's on the port, right? It's on the sea at the edge of the desert. It's a great way to get involved in the spice route. We're going to talk about the Nabataeans in a little bit. So it's a moneymaker. And he wants it. It doesn't fall so easily. He lays siege to the city. He finally conquers it. He massacres all the men. He sells all the women and children as slaves, right? Very horrible story. Despite that, Gaza, like most of the places that Alexander conquers, becomes thoroughly Hellenized, right? This, of course, is the beginnings, the backdrop to the story of Hanukkah. Everybody adopts their own local version of Greek culture. And this statue over here on the right is a statue of Zeus that was discovered in Gaza City. And this idea of taking on Greek ideas of art, of law, of the way to run and design a city, right? This comes to Gaza as well. As we said before, the Maccabees managed to conquer Gaza, right? Jonathan Maccabee, one of the brothers, is responsible for conquering the area of Gaza, but they don't hold on to it. But the dynasty of the Hasmoneans slowly but surely expands their reach. And Alexander Yanai, who is the son of Yohanan Hyrcanus, also greatly expands the Hasmonean kingdom. The grandson of Shimon HaMaccabee, right? Simon the Maccabee, one of the original brothers. He expands, right? And you have this nice map here. The green is before Alexander's reign, and the pink is what he adds. So you have these two important coastal cities, Dor and Gaza, areas in the south as well as on the other side in the Transjordan. Again, same idea, wants a piece of this trade that Gaza is very well equipped to have. And so he makes this part of his kingdom. Like his father, Yohanan Hyrcanus, who, when he conquers the area of Idumea, forces, doesn't force, gives the very persuasive option to convert, okay? Convert or leave. That's basically the choice. And just as the Idumeans, some of them chose to leave and destroyed their homes, but some of them, including Herod's family, chose to convert. Same thing in Gaza. Some people left and some people converted, i.e., they don't become from a Yidden, right? They don't become really good Jews. They become allies of the Hasmonean kingdom. So this is Alexander adding this area to his prize, to his larger reach of his Hasmonean kingdom. The coin over here is an Alexander Yanai coin. We have a lot of them, and they're just a nice souvenir from his reign. So let's talk about this trade. Right, the trade is why everybody wants a piece of Gaza. It's not for the farming, it's not for the agriculture that you could have outside. It's really the opening to the sea. And this is where we get to the story of the Nabataeans. And Nabataeans are a desert people, a nomadic people. Some people suggest that they are a later incarnation of the Idumeans, right? The people of Edom, of Esav. There are similarities in their religion, there are similarities in some of their customs. We don't know that much about the Nabataeans because they did not leave behind a written culture. What did they leave behind? They left behind some of their cities, okay? Most famously, Petra. Right? Petra is the most famous of the Nabataean cities, but the Nabataeans don't start out as city dwellers. They start out as nomads, and their power, we mentioned this last time, is being able to travel in the desert and yet to have water. Okay, they master this concept of cisterns, of trapping the water from flash floods, of having hidden cisterns that nobody can steal from them. And because of that, they become the masters of the spice route. Okay. And they travel, and you have this nice map over here showing their route as well as their way stations, right? And they travel not only through the Negev desert, but across the Saudi Arabian desert, bringing goods from the Mediterranean out to the desert, but bringing these very valuable spices out back to the port where they could be sold all over the Mediterranean. And that makes them very rich and very powerful. Ultimately, they do build settlements. This one on the right here is Avdat in the Negev. We already mentioned Petra, Mamshit, Shifta. We have different ones. And they are really part of the story of why Gaza becomes so significant and so powerful. It's all because it's all about the economy, it's all about the money. Before we get to the synagogue, let's just kind of catch up a little. The Roman ruler Gabinus in the first century, before the Common Era, right? Not very long after Alexander Yanai conquers the area, the Romans come in, they rule over the land of Israel, and he expels the Jews, and that's when we have this Roman calendar, this Gaza calendar from 61. And the Jews do come back. Now, traditionally, we thought the Jews came back in Byzantine times. We hear about them in the time of Constantine. But we have very, very interesting evidence of an even earlier Jewish settlement, but it's not so clear when it's from. Okay? In the 1870s, there was a piece of a pillar that was found near the structure that you see here on the right. This is the Great Mosque of Gaza. The pillar you can see a drawing of it here, has certain things that immediately should signal to you this is Jewish, right? We have a menorah. That's the most obvious. We have a shofar on the right. We have, I know it doesn't look like this, but an etrog, okay, over here on the left. Okay, so menorah, shofar, etrog, classic Jewish symbols. We have Greek writing on the bottom, but we also have Hebrew writing, right? Hanania ben Yaakov in nice Hebrew writing, nice square letters. And this piece of the pillar was found near the mosque. And the question is, was this a synagogue before, obviously long before it was a mosque, right? No Islam yet. And when was the synagogue from? Yitzhak Ben Zvi, right? This is discovered already in the late 19th century. So Yitzhak Ben Zvi, who besides being the second president of Israel, was very much a scholar of Jewish communities. He suggested that this is a synagogue from Roman times, that the Jews already return maybe second, maybe even first century of the Common Era. And this is part of their synagogue. Until we find more pieces, and who knows what's going to be these days, we don't really have proof. Hanania Ben Yaakov is clearly a Jewish name, but it doesn't have to be a second century name. It could be a third century name. But it is a fascinating piece of early Jewish history in Gaza. We're going to see a little bit later a synagogue that becomes a church. Here is a synagogue that eventually becomes a mosque. The Emperor Constantine, right? Remember the Emperor Constantine? He is the one who converts. He has this epiphany. He converts to Christianity, and then he converts all of the empire along with him. He wants to build a church in Gaza. He gets a lot of opposition from the local Jewish community, and so he decides he's going to create a new center, and it's going to be here, right by the sea, Gaza Mayumas. But unfortunately for him, the Jews go there too. So they build their own community there in this city that he builds. And that's where we get really probably the most spectacular and definitely the most famous artifact that we have from Jewish Gaza. And that is the remains of this fabulous synagogue. Okay. In 1965, meaning the Gaza Strip is under the control of the Egyptians, no Jews there. 1965, the Egyptians dig foundations for a casino, and they uncover pieces of this mosaic with these beautiful animals, with Greek writing. At first, they think it's a church, okay? But post-67, more excavations are done, and it becomes very clear that this is not a church, but rather a synagogue, okay? We're going to see that there are Jewish names in the inscription. There's Hebrew. Let's see over here. Hebrew. Whose name is it? David. Okay. We have Jewish symbols. First of all, King David, but we also have grapes, vines, olives. Those are all considered to be very Jewish symbols. The orientation of the building faces Jerusalem. All of these clues tell us that this is a synagogue, but it's really a fascinating synagogue. Now, we'll see the inscription in a minute. We know exactly when the synagogue is from, okay, to the year. Okay? We're talking about the early 6th century of the Common Era. Sorry, everyone's like making little pictures on the PowerPoint. Please don't do that. I know you don't mean to. Okay? So we know when it's from. This is late Byzantine period. If you go see the synagogues in the north, right? If you go to, let's say, Chukok, what we saw before, or which is a little bit earlier, or Beit Alfar, Chamat Tveria, right? You have imagery. So imagery should not be so shocking at this time period, but this is really a particularly spectacular images of all of these animals. You have zebras and giraffes and lions and flamingos and peacocks, and it's just stunning. Okay. So that if you want to see, by the way, pieces of the original, this part, the David piece is in the Israel Museum. Replicas of this, as well as of the animals, you can see in the Good Samaritan Museum near Maale Adumim. I might be mistaken. It might be the original there. I'm not 100% sure, but you could definitely see a replica. Now, take a look at the picture in the middle here. Okay, on the one hand, this is a very good Jewish picture, right? We have King David. He's playing his kinnor, right? His lyre. We have his name written in nice Hebrew letters, right? It's a beautiful Jewish picture. On the other hand, there are a few things here that are odd. Okay, first of all, he is surrounded. I don't know if anybody can see this. I'm going to put a ring around it so everybody will see it. His head has a halo around it, right? It's a little bit faint, but you should be able to see the halo around his head. Halos, Christian saints have halos. Jews don't usually have halos. Okay, so that's one interesting influence. The other interesting influence, and we don't have the whole picture, unfortunately, because it was partly destroyed, is all of the animals that are coming to hear the music, right? That's a really cool thing and rather strange. We don't ever hear about that, certainly not in the Bible. Maybe there are midrashim that talk about animals being drawn to the music of King David, but we have a very clear parallel to this story in Greek mythology, where we have a fellow named Orpheus, who is a musician who charms all the animals. And in Roman times, you have lots of Orpheus mosaics. It's a very common theme in art. People had it in their villas, right? This is one from the late second century from Edessa in Syria. Here is Orpheus. He's playing his lyre and all the animals are coming to listen. So did the artist who made these designs, and we're going to talk about the artist in a minute, maybe very aware of Greek mythology. Maybe there are Christian connections here, right? This is clearly a synagogue that's living in a rather multicultural world, right? So that's a very interesting thing to notice. The inscription, on the other hand, tells us that this is a very Jewish place, right? What's the inscription? Written in Greek, of course. We, Menachem and Yeshua, sons of Yishai the late, Tamanoach, are lumber merchants. As a sign of admiration for the holy site, have donated the mosaic in the month of Laos in the year 569. 569, remember, minus 61. So we are in the year 508 of the Common Era. And one of the things that is eternal in Jewish life is that people who give money for places tend to like their name up in lights. Okay? Not always, but a lot of them do. Okay? And Menachem and Yehoshua are no exception. And we have their names here. So it gives us amazing details about who this is, what kind of place it is, when it's from. The synagogue was, it seems, destroyed in the 7th century. But the mosaic was just buried, only to be found in the 20th century. Now, in this, not far from here, okay, Ma'on is in the area of the Gaza envelope. It's near Kibbutz Nirim of today. Okay? There's another beautiful synagogue, which also has stunning animal medallions in a mosaic, right? Take a look. Not so different from what we see here. Okay? Not only that, not far from there, in the area of Nahal HaBsor, the Bsor River, there was a mosaic discovered in a place called Chirbit Shalala, which is a church, which also had very beautiful animals. Near Be'eri, there was another mosaic that was discovered, which also had beautiful animals, and it was also a church. They're all from the same time, and it seems that they were all made by the same artist or the same artist school, right? And if you think about that, how many commissions are you getting as a mosaic artist? You're taking whatever comes. You're very ecumenical. It's a synagogue. It's a church. I'll take it, right? And that's also just a fascinating proof for us of these communities who are maybe not best friends, but they're certainly living side by side, Jewish and Christian communities, of course, no Muslim communities yet, Jewish and Christian communities using the same resources and often decorating in similar ways. So that's just kind of fun to see. The Jewish community continues with the Muslim conquest. We hear about Karaites who joined the Jews. We hear about them from Karaite writers, as well as from the Cairo Geniza, where we have documents that talk about Jews and Karaites and Samaritans. When the Crusaders arrive, Okay, we're talking about 11th, 12th centuries. The Crusaders come, and like in Jerusalem and in other places, the Jewish community is decimated. Fortunately, here the Jewish community flees, right? They're not really murdered and like they are in Jerusalem. They flee. The city is destroyed. But with the Mamluks who kick out the Crusaders towards the end of the 13th century, the Jews return and Aza becomes extremely important. Okay? I brought you a picture here of the classic four holy cities, right? In medieval times, we talk about the four holy cities of Israel. Okay? Jerusalem, of course, Hebron, Tiberias, and Tzfat. Jerusalem and Hebron, we can understand why they're holy cities. Tveria, the Sanhedrin's there. Tzfat is a little trickier, but they're also considered the four holy cities because this is really where Jews lived, right? These are the Jewish communities in medieval times. As it doesn't make it onto this map, it's not considered one of the four holy cities, but it's a very important place that has a strong Jewish community, which at times is on par or even bigger than the communities in these four holy cities. We hear about Jewish and non-Jewish visitors who come and talk about the community in Aza. Okay, we'll read a couple of these testimonies in a minute, but what we learn is a few different things. The Jews live in the highest part of the city. They have a synagogue. They know the house where Samson and Delilah lived, and they would show it to visitors. They made wine. Remember, we're in Mamluk times. City of Aza is a Muslim city. So if you want to drink wine, you got to make it yourself, right? They're not able to buy wine from their neighbors because their neighbors are not making wine. Jews make wine. And another really fascinating piece of information that we get, not from a Jewish writer, but a non-Jewish writer, is that the Jews wore yellow scarves, right? If we think that a yellow badge or a sign of the Jew is only something from medieval Europe, not true. We have it here as well. So we have various descriptions here with the expulsion from Spain. These two testimonies here are before that, but with the expulsion from Spain and the great exodus of the Jews that are able to get out, we know many Jews make their way to the Ottoman Empire. A lot of them come to Tzfat, and we have, of course, the golden age of Tzfat, but quite a lot of them come to Aza. And we have a census, an Ottoman census, okay? 1525, we have 95 Jewish households in Aza. In 1548, we have 116 Jewish households in Aza. So the numbers are growing. So what do we hear about community? So we have a visitor called Meshulam of Volterra, okay, in 1481, and he tells us about 60 Jewish homeowners. They have a small, beautiful synagogue, vineyards, fields, houses, and they have already started making new wine. And I was greatly honored, especially by Rabbi Moshe, son of Rabbi Yehuda Aspardi. And he stutters a little, right? Meshulam, he tells it as it like it is. And Rabbi Meir Sephardi is a goldsmith, right? Very interesting that he uses the term Sephardi. And the Jews dwell on the heights of the land. May the Lord be praised. And there are a few houses on the heights of the land at the top of the Judaica. By the way, up until not so long ago, the Arabs called this neighborhood at the height of the city Charat al-Yehud, the Jewish street, right? Today, you won't find that on maps of Gaza if you look on Google Maps, but that's what it used to be called, right? We have a different testimony here from Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura. Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura, oh, I spelled Bartanura wrong, sorry. We know that he comes from Italy, lives out his days in Jerusalem. Okay, but he also travels before that. And here we have his testimony on Shabbat. All the elders and the Torah scholars came to dine with us, bringing cakes and grapes as their custom. And we drank 7 or 8 cups before eating and were happy. I love that description. It's just great. Rabbi Ovadia getting drunk with the scholars of Aza. Okay, so we have this very, very busy, big community, but what about a big Knesset? What about a synagogue? And here's where we get to even more interesting archaeological testimony, right? So from the literary testimony, we hear the synagogue was in the highest part of town. Okay? Today, There was a Catholic church in the highest part of town. There are very few Catholics, there are very few Christians in general in Gaza, very few Catholics. One Catholic church, the Church of the Holy Family. It's in the highest part of Gaza. You can see a picture of it here. Unlike other churches in the world, this church faces west. Okay, now what is the direction west? Towards Jerusalem, right? In this area of the church, there were two pillars that were found with inscriptions, and that's what you have written over here. One of them says, "For Shalom Yaakov ben Elazar's sons, in order to give thanks to God for this holy place." Okay, Jewish names, Hebrew names, holy place. And then we have another Hebrew inscription, which is probably more familiar to you in Hebrew. "The angel who redeems me from all evil, Hamalach ha-goel oti mikol ra," but it ends in a different way, "will grant me the privilege of ascending to Jerusalem. Yizakeni la'alot li." Okay, now these pillars were discovered in the area of the church already in the late 19th century. Yitzhak Ben Tzvi tries to buy them from the church fathers. It doesn't work so well. And then they finally manage to buy them. A fellow named Hirschfeld, okay, manages to buy this one of these pillars. And he wants to transport it to Jerusalem, right? And you can see it here on the left. Hamalach ha-goel oti mikol ra. Unfortunately, Zvi Hirschfeld, who was an interesting guy, he was one of the early pioneers. He was one of the founders of Kibbutz Ruhama, but he dies young in 1918. He dies of illness, and he doesn't manage to bring this pillar to Jerusalem. What happens to it? His family takes it and uses it on his grave. And that's what you are seeing over here. You see the pillar with the original inscription, and then underneath the addition, Po Nikbar, Rav Hirsch ben Rabbi Eliyahu Hirschfeld, right? It's a fascinating thing, and it gives us a testimony. This is a grave in Rishon LeZion, in the old cemetery in Rishon LeZion. You can see a piece of the synagogue of Gaza from the Mamluk period. So it's a very strange story how it appeared here, but it does tell us where the synagogue used to be. So far, we don't have more testimony, but this is pretty great testimony in and of itself. Okay, let's talk a little about who are the people in this time of the height of Jewish Gaza. So one of the most famous figures from Gaza is Rabbi Yisrael Najara. In general, the Najara family. Okay, the Najara family are an important family of rabbis. They originally come from Najara in northern Spain. They make their way towards North Africa, Syria, the land of Israel. Rabbi Yisrael's father is Rabbi Moshe Najara. He was a student of the Ari of Rabbi Yitzchak Luria in Tzfat. Then he moved to Damascus. His son Yisrael was born. Okay? Yisrael eventually returns to Tzfat and then makes his way to Gaza. He becomes the chief rabbi of Gaza. When he dies, his son, who is also Moshe, he names him Moshe. He becomes chief rabbi of Gaza. Rabbi Yisrael Najara was buried in Gaza. This is just an old picture of Gaza. It's nothing to do with Rabbi Yisrael Najara. Rabbi Yisrael Najara is famous for writing a bunch of things, but most famously, a book of Zmirot and Piyutim, right? Religious songs. And even if you've never heard of Rabbi Yisrael Najara, chances are good that you heard of his most famous song, which is Ya Ribon Olam, right? One of the Zmirot that both Ashkenazim and Sephardim sing on Shabbat, written in Aramaic, spelling out in an acrostic, as many Paitanim like to do, his name, Yisra. L, okay. All praises to God, asking God to come back and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Sing it to yourself in whatever tune you like, but Yaribon Olam Ve'omaya Antu Malka Melech Malchaya Ovad Gvurtech Vutim Haya Shvar Kadamach Le'achvaya. Lord, you are Lord Hashem, you are Lord forever and ever. You are King of Kings. Your mighty deeds and wonders are pleasant for me to relate. So Rabbi Yisrael Najara gained himself eternal fame by writing the Yaribon. Someone who is infamous as opposed to famous is Shabtai Tzvi. Okay, the Shabtai Tzvi story is a fascinating story. It really deserves its own class. We did that last year when we did our course on medieval Israel. But Shabtai Tzvi really is the one who, not him, but his person who makes him famous, really puts Aza on the world Jewish stage. And that's because Shabtai Tzvi creates the greatest false messianic movement in Jewish history. Shabtai Tzvi comes into the world at a time of a lot of crisis. We're talking about the early 17th century, a lot of crisis in the Jewish world, still reeling from the effects of the expulsion from Spain. You have the Khmelnytsky massacres and the attacks on the Jews in Eastern Europe. Lots of troubles, also lots of messianic expectations. Also, the spread of Lurianic Kabbalah, of the Kabbalah of the Ari, which really kind of gives people a feeling that Messiah, bringing Messiah, is in their own hands. All of these create a perfect storm with the very strange personality of Shabtai Tzvi and of Nathan of Gaza to bring about this huge messianic movement. Shabtai Tzvi is born in Izmir in Turkey in 1626. He has a very strange disposition. Some people thought of him as Saturnine, right? His name, Shabtai, right? Maybe because he's born on Shabbat. Shabtai is the Hebrew name for Saturn. Saturn is considered to be the Jewish Mazal, right? The Jewish astrological sign, planet. But it's also considered to be something that controls melancholia. And Shabtai Tzvi, if he lived today, would probably have a diagnosis of manic depressive or something else. He had highs, he had lows, very, very bright, but very, very strange. In and of himself, probably his belief in himself as the Messiah would not have taken off. But what happens? He travels around. He goes from Izmir to Salonika to Istanbul to Jerusalem. He gets kicked out of places because he does various things like saying you don't have to keep the commandments anymore. He goes to Cairo, and then he eventually makes his way to Aza. He's a very troubled young man, okay? He's gotten married, but he got married. He got his marriage was annulled twice. He marries again, and he is not yet 40 years old, and he gets to Aza. He meets this brilliant character whose name is Nathan Ashkenazi, or Nathan of Gaza, okay, who is quite a lot younger than him. Okay, he's only born in 1623. Shabtai Tzvi is born in 1626. But Nathan of Gaza is a brilliant, brilliant young man. He's a student of Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz in Jerusalem, one of the greatest rabbis of the 17th century. He's a Kabbalist, and he believes that he can do something that the Ari was known to do as well, which is to read souls, to understand what is the root of your soul, who are you reincarnated from, and most importantly, how can you do a tikkun? How can you fix your soul in a way that you will get eternal redemption for it? And Shabtai Tzvi hears about this guy. And he goes to him. He says, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to be, right? Think of it as psychology of the 17th century. Will you give a tikkun to my soul? Okay, now before we find out what Nathan says to Shabtai Tzvi, just read what he says himself. Okay, this is Nathan. When I had attained the age of 20, I began to study the Zohar and the Lurianic writings. According to the Talmud, whoever wants to purify himself receives the aid of heaven. And thus he, God, sent me some of his holy angels and blessed spirits who revealed many mysteries of the Torah to me. That same year, energized by the visions of the angels and the blessed souls, I was engaged in a prolonged fast during the week before the Feast of Purim. I locked myself in a room in holiness and purity, and as I tearfully recited the penitential prayers of the morning service, the spirit came over me. My hair stood on end and my knees shook. And I beheld the Merkavah, the divine chariot, and I saw visions of God all day long and all night. I was vouchsafed true prophecy like any other prophet, as the voice spoke to me, beginning with the words, "Thus speaks the Lord." With utmost clarity, my heart perceived toward whom my prophecy was directed. And only then did the angel permit me to proclaim what I had seen. I recognized that he was the true Messiah. And indeed, the angel that revealed himself to me in my waking vision was a genuine one, and he revealed awesome mysteries to me. Okay, so Nathan, he's 20 years old, 1663. Shabtai Tzvi shows up 2 years later, and he goes to Nathan, and he says, "I want to know what's the root of my soul." And say, Nathan says to him, "You're the Messiah. I had this vision. The Messiah is going to come to me. You are it. You are the Messiah." Shabtai Tzvi not believe him. He says, no, I'm really not. And Nathan says, no, you really are, right? And we have all kinds of fascinating depictions of this story of Shabtai Tzvi, because again, this is the beginning of printing, right? So we have all kinds of images that are put into books, not always Sabbatean books. They're not always aware of what they're printing. This is clearly very Sabbatean. But here you have this large figure. This is Shabtai Tzvi. But here's Nathan of Gaza leading the tribes of Israel. So he is very much the facilitator of Shabtai Tzvi's messianship, I guess is a bad word to use, but he takes Shabtai Tzvi with him. He brings him to Jerusalem. He brings him to Hebron. He convinces him that he is the Messiah. They come back to Gaza on Shavuot. They proclaim him as Messiah. Meanwhile, there is a huge reaction in Jerusalem. The rabbis of Jerusalem, among them, most importantly, Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz, are very opposed to this. They do not agree. They see this as a false Messiah. And Nathan comes along and he says, you know what? Jerusalem is not the holiest city anymore. Gaza is the holiest city now, right? And the whole story of Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of Gaza is really tied up with Gaza and the importance of Gaza. However, okay, Shabtai Tzvi leaves the land of Israel, goes to Turkey, goes to Izmir. He's finally imprisoned in Adrianople, and he's given a very stark choice. Either you renounce your claim to being the Messiah and convert to Islam, or you will be executed. Shabtai Tzvi doesn't have to think too long. He chooses to become a Muslim. Many, many, many of his followers are disillusioned, although there are still people who continue to believe in him and go underground. What happens to Nathan? Nathan is essentially in exile. Wherever he goes, he's persona non grata. He ends up in Macedonia in a city called Skopje. He dies in 1680. But the fate of Shabtai Tzvi also affects the fate of Gaza. It goes way down after this fiasco with Shabtai Tzvi, but it definitely puts Gaza on the map, the Jewish map, in a not a good way, but a very powerful way. The community goes down. It's not very significant anymore. The next blow comes from Napoleon, right? Napoleon, as part of his attempt to dominate the world, goes from Egypt up the coast of the land of Israel, conquers Gaza, conquers Jaffa, and is turned back only at Akko. But when he gets to Gaza, the Jewish community says, we've heard this story before, and they flee to Hebron. Remember, we said there's a Hebron-Gaza connection. Hey, they flee to Hebron, closest city that they feel they can be safe in. Do they return? Do some of them return? It's unclear. But in 1835, the new ruler in the land of Israel is someone named Ibrahim Pasha, and he goes to the synagogue on the top of the hill, right? Remember that synagogue? He orders it dismantled and the stones used to build a fortress in Ashkelon. The Jews manage to save the wooden doors from the synagogue. And where do they bring them? They bring them to Hebron, and they use them. They put them as the doors on the beautiful synagogue of the Avraham Avinu synagogue. Now, the picture you see here on the right is the Avraham Avinu synagogue in Hebron after it was restored. Right? It was restored very, very painstakingly post 67. It was desecrated horrifically in 1929. In 1929, when the synagogue was desecrated, these doors disappeared. Right? Were they stolen? Were they destroyed? We don't know. So this last remaining piece of that famous synagogue in Aza went to Hebron and is no longer. Will the doors one day turn up? Who knows? All right, but that's that connection again of Aza and Hebron. Jews are kicked out, but again, we keep seeing this, right? They don't give up. They say, we want to come back. You're saying, why is there a picture of tea here? Because our story here is connected to Mr. Ze'ev Vitsotsky, the gentleman on the left who looks very wealthy because he was the tea king. He was the Russian Jewish tea king. He founded the Vysotsky Tea Company, which was huge. Today we think of Vysotsky as an Israeli company, but really it was a huge Russian company. He was also a Jewish philanthropist. And in 1885, he comes on a trip to the land of Israel and he makes an interesting suggestion, right? 1885, we're just at the very beginning of the first Aliyah, which starts in 1882, Jewish communities building small moshavim like Zichron Yaakov, like Rishon LeZion. Vysotsky says, I have a better idea. Why should we start from scratch with these farming communities? Jews should move into existing Arab towns and build their communities there, right? What is he talking about? He's talking about places like Gaza, but also Shechem, Beit Lechem, Lud, Ramla, okay? And he says, the first places I want to rebuild are Gaza and Shechem. Easier said than done. So what does he do? He goes to the Jewish community in Jaffa, and he gets two people to support. One is a money guy, Avraham Shelush, who's the guy behind the neighborhood of Neve Tzedek, the precursor to modern Tel Aviv. But then he also gets the actual people who are going to come and do the work of settling. And that's this couple over here, the Nisim and Mazal Al-Kayam, who were very well known and respected in both the Jewish and the Arab communities in Gaza. And they pick themselves up from Jaffa. They move to Gaza. 30 families come with them. Mostly merchants, and not only do they establish a community there for people who live there permanently, but it becomes a very important place for travelers. Any Jews who are going down to Egypt, they're going to stop in the Jewish community in Gaza. And they build it up. There are three synagogues. There's a mikvah. There's a cemetery. There's a Hebrew school, right? Crazy idea. There's a modern Hebrew school. Eliezer ben Yehuda suggests building a school. There's even a branch of the Anglo-Palestine Bank, right? The precursor to Bank Leumi, the Zionist Bank. 1914, Jewish Aza is booming. And then World War I, right? And we keep seeing this cycle of growth, flourishing, destruction. The British come. They want to conquer. They come from the south. They attempt to conquer Aza once. They attempt to conquer it twice. Both times very disastrous and unsuccessful. The picture on the left is British, the artillery outside of Gaza. They are unsuccessful. Where are they successful? In Beersheba. And they managed to conquer Beersheba. And once they conquer Beersheba, they can come back and conquer Aza. The picture on the right here is a reenactment of the Anzac forces, the Australian and New Zealand light horsemen, right? The regiments that charged in the Battle of Beersheba and managed to conquer Beersheba. But the British finally do conquer Gaza. Many, many casualties, unfortunately. And among the cemeteries, the British cemeteries in Israel, we have in Jerusalem, Haifa, Ramla, and we also have in Beersheba, in Gaza. Amazingly, it looks just like the ones in the other places. There are actually caretakers who, an Arab family that have been caretakers of the cemetery for decades. But in the video that I want to show you now, which was going to work, I never do videos in PowerPoints, you'll see something from very, very recently. Are you hearing the sound? Just nod.
Yes, we hear. We're not hearing sound though, not now.
Okay, that's a video that my son sent me. He, not him, but he got it from somewhere, where Jewish soldiers, right? Tzal soldiers went to the cemetery and said Kaddish at the Jewish graves in the British cemetery, which is amazing. Okay, the British come and they rebuild. They plan the city. They build a new hospital called the Shifa Hospital, which is rebuilt by the Jews, by Israel in the 1970s, by the way. Another crazy story. They build an airport, a okay? And Jewish community starts to be rebuilt, but this time it doesn't really work because the Zionist organizations are not particularly interested. They don't want to rebuild in Gaza. They have other plans. There's Tel Aviv and there's Jerusalem and there's also all the farming communities, and they don't really provide much backing. So the British are here. There's an airport. Eventually this is eclipsed by the airport in Lod. Post 1967, the airport is used again. It's called Menachat Karni. Okay? Why Karni? Because there was a businessman named Yosef Karni who was involved in. He created a big warehouse of produce, Israeli, Arab, right? And this became the Karni Crossing, where shipments were sent from Israel to Gaza and vice versa. This was all closed down during the second Intifada. All of this comes to a halt in 1929. 1929, we know riots all over the country, Jewish communities, Jerusalem, Hebron, Sfat, Tveria, everywhere. In Gaza, they knew trouble was coming, and Nisim Al-Qayyam gathers all the Jews into a Jewish hotel on Shabbat, August 1929. The British police guard them, but then they flee. There's an attempt to protect them by a friend of Al-Qayyam, an Arab friend called Haj Said Ashaya. Again, he's frightened away by the mob. Ultimately, the British come back. They manage, despite the mob and the attacks, to load the Jews on trucks, to bring them to the train station in Gaza, and to evacuate them. But this is really the end of the Jewish community in Gaza, until 2023, where we have Golani soldiers in the building of the Hamas parliament. This famous picture from a couple of months ago. And what will be the future? We do not know. So let me take a look at some of these many, many questions and comments in the 2 minutes that I have. All right, hold on. Going back to the front here. All right, let's see. Mute, 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 mute. Okay. Shimshon, pictures from Chukok. The name Aza may come from the Arabic razu, meaning a raid. Interesting. Plisha and plishtim. Interesting. I never saw that, but that's kind of neat. Okay, Wikipedia. Yes. Yes, Mayumas is by the water. Exactly. Correct. Your halo looks more like a crown for a king. If you look at Christian iconography and pictures of saints, they have that halo. Right? So it is like a crown, but it's a halo. Okay, there's a lighter area. The month of Laos. I do not know. I'm sure it is known. I do not know. Okay. Please share the PowerPoint is there's a YouTube of all of the whole course. Chorva Synagogue originally had animal designs, then they reconstructed it and frommed it out and took out the animal designs. I did not know that. That's interesting. Very cool. No, I'm not putting the PowerPoint in the chat, but you can watch it on YouTube. Okay. B'nai Yeshurim frequently showcases Piyutim by Rabbi
Ending in
Yisrael
2 minutes.
Majera. What? Okay, the Mamluks are the guys who kick out the Crusaders. We will not go back into it more deeply. Nachal HaBesor was the announcement pamphlet for the he first Hebrew magazine. Interesting. Okay, I don't know what this is. Ibn Ezra put us under Capricorn Saturn, although he said the Jews transcend Mazal. Exactly, right? There's this idea that the Jews do have astrology, but the Jews are above astrology, right? Very interesting. Shabtai Tzvi and Tzivos Hashem, very nice. I was frozen. That's not good. All right. All right, but I seem to have come back. All right. Wysocki was once the largest tea trading company in the world. Yes, and we still have Wysocki tea. Okay, thank you. That's it. Thank you, everyone.
Julie,
We will now.
PowerPoint never
Thank
played.
you.
It
Thank
didn't play.
you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We didn't hear the PowerPoint at all.
Didn't see the PowerPoint?
It didn't work. It didn't go on.
Okay, I think that may be just you, at least I hope.
We heard you.
But
I
okay,
saw it.
but you can by tomorrow or at the very most Friday, Torah in Motion puts up the whole recording on YouTube, on their YouTube channel. So you can go and you can see it, you can see it muted, you can see it speeded up, but it's there. Okay?
I
Next.
also didn't get the link in the chat.
The link was just to the sources also on the Torah in Motion website.
No, okay.
Okay. Next week we will be going to, we're going to be talking about the 1940s and the War of Independence. Thank you, everybody. See you next week. Be'ezrat Hashem, b'sorot
Julie,
thank you.
thank
Thank
you.
Julie,
Yes.
it should be pointed out, and you didn't do it, but when I'm reading articles about Gaza, because obviously it's in the news, and they talk about the history as you did, and it's quite interesting. When they talk about the Romans converting everybody to Christianity, they use very forceful, warlike words. When it's the, and these are people sympathetic to Gaza, when they talk about Islam, and then it became Islamic. It wasn't under, they don't talk about the sword in the same way. And that's interesting to note that they're trying to hide the violence that the Islam and Gaza does, but everybody else, Christianity commits it under the sword. And it's something in all the articles that are sympathetic to Gaza, and it belies the real history of it, of Islamic conquest
Yes.
altogether, and people should be aware of it. That's all.
Yes. If we tried to fight all the lies that are out there, we would have no time for anything else. But I hear your point. I hear your point. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you. It
Take
was
care, everyone.
fabulous.
Thank you.